to you. We have ushers that will come down and give those to you. And as I say every week, if you don't own a Bible, take that home with you. It is our gift to you, and we'd be happy to pass that along. We are in Mark chapter 9. We're going to start at verse 1. I need to let you know that the passage that we are going to look at today, the first 13 verses of Mark chapter 9, is a strangely befuddling text. It is beautifully freaky. I mean, there's just no other way of describing it to you. In a book, in a letter, in a gospel like Mark that has many, many strange, unique, wonderful events, this one may trump them all. It's one of those passages that is just tough, even in a Sunday morning, to kind of get all of it. I think there's so much going on in it, but it is a great passage, and we're going to walk through it, but you just need to know it's a strange one, a beautifully strange one, a wonderful, befuddling passage. And again, we've looked at many of them already in Mark's gospel. We've seen some strange events. We've seen one-on-ones with Satan, Jesus and Satan. We've seen these one-on-one battles. We've seen the feeding of masses on a tight budget, right? I mean, that's strange by itself. We've seen the killing of 2,000 pigs, right? But you can't win. When you kill 2,000 pigs, you can't win, right? Because you tick off the vegetarians because you killed pigs, and then you tick off the meat eaters because you wasted meat. But we've seen the 2,000 pigs, strange event, and we've also seen events like the walking on water. Just amazing events. But again, this one, I'd like to suggest to you, again, may take things to another level. It's also one of those events, like many of them in Mark's gospel, that although by itself stands out, although by itself you could just kind of lock yourself into these 13 verses and get some things out of it, it's one of those events, again, like many in Mark's gospel, that is dependent upon us understanding what has taken place leading up to it, if we're going to come to a greater sense of understanding, a greater sense of clarity. So it's important for us to remember what leads into it. And also, this passage specifically is a passage that, if you don't have maybe at least a bit of an understanding on the Exodus, specifically Moses and his encounter with God on Mount Sinai, you may not get a full understanding of it. And so I encourage you this week, if you've never read, say, Exodus 24 to 32, 33, read that passage. If it's been a while, just remind yourself of what goes on, because we will be kind of referencing those two things. The Exodus, specifically Moses on Mount Sinai, and also the event that takes place leading up to this one. And I will just remind you of it at the end of Mark chapter 8. We spent a few weeks in it because it is such a significant moment in the life and ministry of Jesus, especially as Mark records it for us. If you remember, at the end of the book of at the end of Mark chapter 8, Jesus presents the question, asks that all-important question, who am I? Who do you say I am? That's the question, the response, or the testimony from Peter, who seems to be speaking on behalf of the disciples, is, you are the Christ. That's the response, that's the testimony of Peter, which leads to the clarification, right, of Jesus. You are right, Peter, but this is the type of Christ. This is the kind of Messiah that I am. I am the suffering Messiah who will suffer at the hands of the religious leaders, among others. They will instigate that suffering process. And I am the kind of Messiah, the type of Messiah that calls my disciples to follow after me in a like manner, that they will pick up the cross and follow me. That's my call. And so that's what leads up to this event. That's important for us to understand, because it's going to help us, again, clarify some things in this passage. So that's the question of Jesus, that's the testimony of Peter, and that's the clarification of Jesus, which sets up what happens next. So let's pick it up. Let's read verse 1, which is where we sort of left off last week, which kind of is a prophetic word in regards to what takes place next. There's controversy over that, but the way I see it is verse 1 is a prophetic word about what's going to take place in verses 2 to 13. So let's look at verse 1. Jesus says to them, I tell you the truth, Some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God come with power. I think that's a prophetic word. Let's pick it up and see what takes place next. Starting at verse 2, it says this, "After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John," some of them, that's how I would read that, "some of them with Jesus and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone." Let's just stop there. Now, if you've been studying along with us and you kind of have your antenna up and you're looking for different things, you will note right from the beginning, if you are awake yet, that you can tell that from the beginning that this is going to be a significant event. And the reason why you can tell this is going to be a significant event is because Mark references a specific period of time. He says, after 6 days. Now, why that's significant is because outside of the Passion Week, the crucifixion week, this is the only time that Mark gets really specific about time. In fact, it is so contrary to how he writes the gospel. Because Mark is, man, he's just kind of busting through things. And he talks a lot about immediacy and at once. And man, we just had to get at it. And we did this. And this is what happened next. And he has this sense of rush, or kind of a rush aspect to the ministry of and life of Jesus and the disciples and so on and so forth. So, but here, the only place again, he gets very specific about time. He says, after 6 days. Now, what does this tell us? Well, I think it suggests two very, very important things. One is it ties this event with what took place immediately previous to it. So when you read after 6 days, if you were reading this passage as a standalone event, you would go, okay, what happened 6 days ago? I need to know what happened 6 days ago, because there's a tie into it, at least in some way, shape, or form. So that's number one. It ties it together. And that's what I said in sort of our introduction, that you need to read this event in light of what happened previously to it, immediately previous to it, 6 days before. That's one of the reasons why I think it stands out. The other reason why it stands out is what I inferred to in our introduction, and that is this event needs to be read in light of Moses and his encounter with God on Mount Sinai, where God revealed himself to Moses, his countenance changed, he got the law of God, the Torah, and so on and so forth. And I think there is a connection there when Mark says, after 6 days, let me show you why I say this by reading a passage that comes out of Exodus 24. You can read it on the screen. It goes like this. "When Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. For 6 days, the cloud covered the mountain, and on the seventh day, the Lord called to Moses from within the cloud." So we've talked about it enough over these last several months, but just to remind you, there is a connection between Jesus as the new leader of the new Exodus, the new Moses, the perfect leader leading a perfect Exodus. And so we see again a correlation between the two. So after 6 days of Jesus and his encounter with the disciples, "Who am I? You are the Christ." 6 days later, we read that this takes place. 6 days after this dialogue. And what we read is that Jesus and Peter and James and John, they head out together. Now, why just them? Why just them? Well, we don't know. We don't really have a clear understanding on why Jesus just takes these three. We do know, as you read the story of Jesus in the Gospels, that over a period of time, this becomes an inner core group from the disciples. This is a group that, for whatever reason, maybe they display a faithfulness, an understanding, and a leadership ability. Maybe they have an affinity to Jesus that the other nine didn't have. We don't know. We just know that from the 12, Jesus has designated these three for some specific and special situations. This is the group, for example, in Mark 5, Jesus takes with him when he raises the dead girl. They're a part of this very unique, befuddling, beautifully bewildering situation. That was good words right there. And we will see that in the garden, at the Garden of Gethsemane, toughest word to say in the Bible, Gethsemane, then Jesus, when he prays with his disciples, he takes these three away specifically to pray for him and with him. So this is a unique group. Question is, wouldn't the other nine be really disappointed, ticked off, troubled, hurt, doesn't seem to be a concern for whatever reason. They just don't get to take part in some of the big events. And we don't know. We just know that this is who Jesus rolled with. Right? This is his crew. All right, they'd be, you know, dark glasses, FUBU t-shirts, right, earpieces. They talk in the third person. They rolled with Jesus, right? This is his crew he hung out with. And so Jesus and his crew, they head off, and we read, they go up to a high mountain. Now, you need to know something. I actually prepare before I speak on Sunday mornings. Maybe amazing to you. There is so much written on which mountain. I mean, just pages and pages. Could be this one, could be that one. This is the reason why it's this one. It wouldn't work for that one. Page after page after page after page. Here's my conclusion. It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. All you need to know about mountains in the Bible are that cool things happen on mountains in the Bible. That's all you need to know, all right? Now, if you go to seminary and you need to write a thesis, write a thesis on mountains, all right? You'll get just a ton of information. So we don't know which one. We just know that it's the possibility between two near Caesarea Philippi where Jesus is, and Jesus and his crew head up one of the mountains, either Mount Tabor or Mount Hermon. So here we are. Just the four of them just finished the grind, right? At the top of the mountain, they're feeling good about themselves. They're eating granola bars, right? They're talking about how hip and cool they are. And then all of a sudden, we pick up the story halfway through verse 2. It says this. There he was. That's Jesus. Look halfway through verse 2. There Jesus was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there before them appeared Elijah and Moses who were talking with Jesus. What is this? What is this? Well, this is what we know for sure. Okay? First off, we read that Jesus was transfigured before them, which is seen in Jesus and his clothes becoming dazzling and literally intensely white. It's a radical transformation and reminds us again of Moses' countenance that was changed in his encounter with God when he met God on Mount Sinai. And we get a sense of sort of this difficulty in Mark describing this, right? Mark's describing, he says, this is beyond what anybody could bleach. This is really, really white. This is, to put it in 2006 language, this is Clay Aiken white. This is really white. All right. This is the kind of, some of you don't get, that's okay. All right. For the three of you that do, you know, you're welcome. All right. This is really, really, really white. This is like when I go to the beach after a long winter, right? Take my shirt off, right? Babies start crying, right? Dogs start barking, people running for their cars, Eskimos yelling, spirit bear, right? I mean, it's that kind of white. It's really white, right? It's dazzlingly. It's just amazingly white. So we know that for sure. It's that kind of white. The second thing that we know for sure is something about this word transfiguration. And that's the word where we get the English equivalent from the Greek word, where we get the word metamorphosis. Tadpoles turn into frogs, right? Caterpillars turn into butterflies, right? Michael Jackson turns into something, right? That's a metamorphosis. It's a changing. It's a radical. I've just ticked off all my Clay Aiken fans and all my Michael Jackson fans. It's a word that outside of the accounts of the transfiguration event itself. So outside of the accounts in the gospel of the transfiguration, it's a word, the Greek word, where we get metamorphosis. It's a word that comes up in the New Testament twice. Two times. One of the times that it comes up in the New Testament is in a verse that we actually looked at last week, a very well-known verse in the Bible if you've been around for a while. It's a verse that comes up in Romans 12:2, a verse that many of us know where we receive the instruction from Paul, do not conform, but be transformed, be transfigured, undergo metamorphosis, How do we do that? By the renewing of our minds. So we see the instruction there. We need to renew our minds to go through that metamorphosis, that transfiguration. And then we see another word, another usage of the word in 2 Corinthians 3 where we read, and you can see this on the screen, it says this, "And we who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory are being transformed." There's our word again. "Into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit." So what do we see here? Because these two verses are really important for us to kind of understand if we're going to get a sense on what's going on here. Well, one of the things that we see in Romans 12 is that we have a call to be transfigured, to be transformed. Again, how? By the renewing of our minds. Right? So we get that instruction. We have a call to be transfigured, you and I. The second thing that we see in that Corinthian passage is that it extends things by saying that we are transformed into the likeness of Jesus with what? Ever-increasing glory. So in reading these two passages, we get a sense of what's going on. Firstly, with Jesus, what we have in Mark 9 in the transfiguration of Jesus is the display of his glory as King, as God, as Messiah, as Lord. It's a display in a very physical sense of the glory of Jesus. It's number one. Number two, and this is the challenge to us in understanding what happened, is that what takes place in Jesus physically is a call for us spiritually. We are called to undergo metamorphosis by the Spirit through the renewing of our minds to the glory of the Father, becoming like Jesus in the process. In other words, as white as Jesus was physically, so too are we to be like that spiritually, inwardly, dazzlingly white. We need to stand out like that. That's our call. So we have the glory of Jesus being displayed, and we have the call in there as well. So if that's taking place, the question that you and I may have at this point is, why is this taking place? If that's what is happening, why is it happening? And I think that's a good question. Here's a couple of reasons why I think this is taking place. And I think it's, again, found in the importance of remembering what took place just previously leading up to us, up to this text. The first reason why I believe this takes place, number one reason, it serves as a reminder and a further revelation that although Jesus is the suffering Messiah, right? This is what takes place leading up to it. Jesus is the suffering Messiah, the suffering Son of Man who's going to suffer many things at the hands of the religious. Even though he is that, he will not stay like that. He will not be that kind of Messiah forever. Where do we see this? You see this in many, many texts. Philippians 2, 5 to 11, a great example. He comes as slave. He returns as what? The God who every knee will bow to the glory of the Father. So we get this reminder of this sort of complete picture of Jesus in a few passages, one after the other. This is who I am. This is what I'm coming for. But you need to understand this about me as well. So it serves as a reminder, a revelation of the type of Messiah Jesus is in a full picture view. Here's another thing that I think it does, and I think this is important for us. It serves as an encouragement to the disciples. And this is why I think it's so vital to remember where we've come from. Because remember the dialogue that they've had, right? It's tough dialogue leading up to this passage. Who do you say I am? You're the Christ. You're right. I'm a suffering Christ. And you're going to suffer. You're going to pick up your cross and you're going to die with me. That's tough discussion. That's tough talk. Sometimes we read that so fast we forget to put ourselves in the place of the disciples, the hearers, and also Jesus. So you're kind of going, wow. Man, I had a totally different picture of what you'd be like, right? And they did. And I got a totally different picture on what discipleship would look like. And it certainly didn't have anything to do with crosses. And so 6 days after the fact, and I would guarantee you, I can't guarantee you, I would think that those were six tough days. From what we know about the disciples, I'm sure some of them are going, oh man, you ready for this? Right? Because we know they don't have a clear picture of Jesus. We know that their hearts are still hard. We know that they have eyes but don't clearly see yet. And so I think what we have here is we have an encouragement going on. That, you know what, even though this is me and I'm going to suffer and I'm going to die, I'm not going to stay like that. That I am going to be glorified. That this is where I'm heading. So I think what part of this is an encouragement to the disciples that this is who Jesus is, and his resurrection will become our resurrection. So I think it's a picture of hope as seen in the glory of Jesus. And I think that's part of what's going on. I quoted a passage at the end of our time last week, but in Colossians 3, it says this, when Christ, you can read it on the screen, Colossians 3, 4, when Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in what? Glory. So I think it's a picture of an encouragement. It's a picture of further revelation. It's a picture, it's reminding us of who Jesus is. And so here we are. What started out as a private party on the top of a mountain with Jesus, Peter, James, and John is now joined by a couple of, I don't know, party crashers, right? We see that there's a couple of different people, new people, a couple of major players, by the way. In religious terms, the two people that join this mountaintop summit meeting are major players in the story of God. These are the Tom Hanks and the Brad Pitts of the religious story, okay? Type A, you know, just list, A-list type of individuals. We read here that Moses and Elijah arrive, and as you can see at the end of the verse there, we're talking with Jesus. Now, again, the question that we need to ask is, of all the people in the Old Testament that could have shown up, why these two? Why Moses and why Elijah? And again, there is a lot of debate, there's a lot of discussion, there's a lot of dialogue, there's a lot of conjecture about why these two, of all the people in the Old Testament, arrive. What is so significant about these two? Again, lots of ideas. Here are some of them. Some people suggest that these two individuals represent the Old Testament, meaning that Moses represents the law and Elijah represents the prophets. So what you have is two symbols in a very physical sense representing the law and the prophets, which encapsulates the Old Testament. And what do we know about the law and the prophets? Well, Jesus says this on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. You can read it on the screen. It says this, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." And then after his resurrection, in what I would think would have been the greatest Bible study ever given, Jesus on the road to Emmaus with two of his disciples who do not even recognize him, Jesus gives them a Bible study. And he walks through, and this is what we read in Luke 24. It says this, that beginning with Moses and the prophets, Jesus explained to them what was said in all of the scriptures concerning himself. So the law and the prophets point to Jesus as he comes to fulfill them, and perhaps Moses and Elijah were representing the law and the prophets. It's a very common idea. I think that's probably a good way to go. But again, there's some debate on it. But why else do they serve as probably good people to be there with Jesus on this mountaintop experience? Well, a couple other things. They also participate in their own ministry lives in some significant mountaintop experiences. We've talked about Moses enough. We know about his mountaintop experience. But Elijah, he had a great mountaintop experience. He had this sort of bad boy confrontation with the prophets of Baal, right? Remember that one? Love Elijah there. Great, great, great story. Elijah, you know, that's the one where he, you know, hey, you know, maybe your gods are sleeping, right? Maybe your gods are on vacation, right? He has this big, he smites hundreds of prophets. So he has this significant, like Moses, mountaintop experience. Also, we know this. Moses and Elijah were involved with leading God's people to places of deliverance. Again, Moses, Exodus, out of Egypt in the Promised Land. And also Elijah, he led God's people away from false gods. And again, Moses specifically, not to be redundant, but to remind ourselves, Moses and his experience on Mount Sinai has so many correlating points in his experience with what's going on here in Jesus and his as well. So it makes sense that both these individuals are here. So although we don't know for sure, it just seems logical that of all the people that could have been here, Moses and Elijah are a good choice. You know, it just makes sense. But again, we don't know for sure. However, and this is vitally important, and I want to make sure that we get this. Even though Moses and Elijah are part of the who's who of Old Testament people, players, individuals, they need to be seen simply as forerunners to the culmination of God's plan, which is realized in Jesus. We need to not see them as any more than that. And I'll make this very clear as we kind of continue walking through this passage. I mean, Romans 10, among other many places, makes this abundantly clear when it says this: Christ is the end of the law so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. Christ is the end. Now, here's a question. Maybe you never even thought about it. And you seem rather quiet today and subdued, so I'm not sure why that is, so I'm just going to spend some time hanging out with you. Have you ever wondered how the disciples, Peter, James, and John, knew that it was Moses and Elijah? Because we're not told, right? We're not told. How is it? I mean, maybe Moses does look like Charlton Heston, right? Maybe he does. Maybe he has that look, right? Maybe they had sort of monogrammed names on their robes. Maybe that's a heaven thing. Maybe you get that, right? I don't know. Big swooping letters. I don't know, right? Maybe Moses had a big tattoo. I mean, it would make sense if Moses, I mean, if I was Moses, right, the big split Red Sea, Moses down the divide, right, it'd be like walking around like that. I mean, maybe Moses had a tattoo. I don't know. Maybe Jesus introduced them and we just didn't read about it. Right, Moses, Elijah, Peter, James, John, Moses, Elijah, right, doctor. Maybe it was that kind of situation. I don't know. We don't get it. Or perhaps they just had some divine revelation that it was them. And I'm good with that. But we don't get it. Sometimes, again, we read over things so fast, we go, how did that happen? We don't know. We just know that in some way, shape, or form, could be very simple explanation, could be something more divine in nature, they knew it was Moses and Elijah. And as I mentioned at the end of verse 4, we read that they were talking to Jesus. That Moses and Elijah were talking to Jesus. Now, we don't know in Mark's account of this story what they were talking about. But in Luke's account, we get some further revelation about what the discussion entailed. And this is so good. Just read the passage on the screen behind me. Let me read it for you. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor. What they were, splendor talking with Jesus, they spoke about his departure. Keep this on, by the way, Ed, if you don't mind after. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. So this is what we know from Luke's further revelation. They get in a discussion, and they get in a discussion about what? His departure. Do you know the Greek word for departure? Exodus. Isn't that good? Isn't that good? I mean, I know we've talked about the correlation between Jesus' exodus with Moses and all of that, but we need to understand it is so tight for us to talk about it without bringing it back to that. We make a mistake. But they come and talk to him about his exodus, which is fulfilled where? In Jerusalem. What happens in Jerusalem? The cross. It's great. So they come, and Jesus reveals himself in his glorified state. Fully glorified? No, I think we get a taste, a prelude. Moses and Elijah come down, and they start talking to him about his exodus that he is leading that will be fulfilled on the cross. Now, I want to be really clear about some things before we move ahead. I don't want to have us see Moses and Elijah as some sort of, I don't know, master Jedi warriors. Okay, you know, sort of like Yoda and Obi-Wan Kenobi coming back. You know, here, Jesus, you need to do this. They're not coming back to instruct Jesus. They're coming back to testify, to bear witness, to be the physical amen to Jesus. They come back as confirmation of who Jesus is and what he is all about. Remember, Jesus says in many, many passages, and in the passage that we just looked at, that he is the one. He is the one who's going to be traveling this way, and he spoke boldly about it. So the role of Moses and Elijah is not to come down as some sort of directive party, giving instruction. They're not those guys. They're not those guys. They are confirmation. They are a picture that Jesus is the fulfillment of what they represent. Let's pick up the story in verse 5. What happens next, I think, is both very humorous and very telling. And I hope you're okay. You guys okay? You good today? You happy? I need to give you a hug? You're all right, right? Good. All right. Good deal. Let's read verses 5 and 6. Let me pick it up. Peter said to Jesus, Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Then verse 6, great commentary added by Mark. Remember, Mark hung out with Peter. So this commentary is probably coming from Peter, obviously, I would think. He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. I love this. You know, sometimes we take pot shots at Peter. I like Peter. Right? Peter's a good guy. He gets himself in trouble, but obviously he displayed great leadership ability, great faithfulness. He experienced some things, both the good and bad of things. And I just like Peter. Peter seems to be the kind of guy that gets really uncomfortable when it gets quiet, though. Right? He's like, I don't like when it's quiet. I got to say something. Right? And so he's sitting there kind of watching this. And he just kind of finally breaks. Ah, Jesus! Jesus, I got a great idea. Why don't I build some condos for you guys? Great view, right? It's high, it's mountain, right? I'll put some sweet amenities in there. I'll cut you a deal. All right, I mean, it's just I'll build these things for you. I think it would be perfect. It would be perfect for you. Now, we need to ask the question, what, Peter, why are you saying this? Why are you ruining this very significant moment? Well, verse 6, I think, gives us some clear answers. I think Peter just freaked out. I mean, I think him and James and John, they're like, what is going on? I think they're like that, you know, that guy that's trying to ask that girl out on a date and he really doesn't know what to say. You eat, right? I eat. Why don't we eat together? All right. Just that grade 8 kid at the dance doesn't know what to say, but he's got to say something. All right. So he has this. So I think there's a part where Peter is just freaked. He's bewildered. And James and John, and they're maybe nudging. Say something. Say something. And so there's part of that. I also think, for the more serious and theological amongst us, we get a picture, I think, of Peter's preconceived notion of God's plan and work in the annals of history. And you're like, what? Well, you need to understand that in Judaism, especially leading up to this, and there's great verses, and I'll talk about that, how they actually do get fulfilled, there was this expectation that when the Messiah came, that he would come and reside with his people again, like he did in journeying with the Israelites through the Exodus. That he would literally reside with them again. There was this expectation that this would happen again. In fact, the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of the Booths, was this anticipation that one day this would be fulfilled, that God would live, that God would tabernacle with his people. Now, does this take place? Yes. Is it fulfilled? Yes. It continues to be fulfilled today. How? God resides with us. Where? In the temple. Which temple? Us. That's soft. I mean, he's in that chapel. I almost got lost. Pull it out, right? I mean, that's the deal. Right? So he does fulfill that. That's why Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, your body is the temple. That's why Jesus looks at the temple in Jerusalem and goes, there's no big deal. I'll knock this bad boy down. Right? Why? Because Jesus is the fulfillment of all of that. And we continue to experience that. But in Peter's mind, I think, and you can sort of appreciate it, right? You're on this mountaintop. You're seeing all this around you. You are living in expectation of this. And you're going, here it is. Finally, here it is. And so he says, this is a great deal. I need to start building some condos. I need to start building some. I mean, they're living here. This is going to be fantastic. So I think you get that part of Peter, that he is living in great expectation of that. But you know what I think we also get here is I think, again, we also get a picture that still Peter, among the other two, still don't quite get who Jesus is. Let me explain this. Let's say you're at your house. Here's a cheesy illustration. You're at your house, your condo, your apartment, your van down by the river, wherever you live. Okay? You're there, you're hanging out, all of a sudden you get a knock on your door. Who's there? Right? Who's there? It's Jesus. All right? And with me is Moses and Elijah. Oh, okay, I'll get the door. Don't worry about it. Boom, they appear in front of you. Right? It's like, how'd you do that? Right? I'm Jesus, this is Moses, and this is Elijah, right? I'm here. You're like, man, nice to have you guys. Good having you here. And then you're thinking, man, you know, they need to sit down. And let's say you look around your apartment, your condo, whatever, and you got three chairs. One's a really nice chair, right? Big boy chair. I call my boys. I go, let's go hang out on a big boy chair. That's where we pray together, hang out, read books. It's a big, it's a nice, comfy big boy chair. You have a big boy chair, and then you have two little folding things from IKEA, right? And you're looking at the three people. Can I just give you a hint? Give the big boy chair to Jesus. Give the big boy chair to Jesus. Moses and Elijah, you fight over those two. You think, well, I need to feed these guys. So you go to your fridge. You look in your fridge. One big, nice piece of chicken. And a couple rice cakes in the cupboard. You think, man, who am I going to give this to? Can I just give you a hint again? Give the big piece of chicken to Jesus. Let the other two fight over the rice cakes. So you think, well, they want to spend the night. You got one bed. You got two couches. Let Moses and Elijah have the couches. Give the bed to Jesus. What's my point? They're not the same. They're not the same. Moses and Elijah aren't on the same ground with Jesus. They are not like Jesus. And I think what we have here in Peter is not quite getting that. He says, I need to build some homes. I'm going to build a home for each of you. I don't think he got it yet. And I think this point is hammered home to us in a very, very significant way in verse 7. Look at verse 7. It begins this way. Then a cloud appeared and enveloped them. Or enveloped them. Enveloped them. Now, in Scripture, clouds are good things. Clouds are good things. Clouds are places where God speaks, reveals himself. They're used as symbols of God's presence. And we saw that earlier when we read the verse in Exodus 24 about the account of Moses in the presence of God, how the cloud came over Mount Sinai for those 6 days. And like in that account where God speaks from the cloud, so too does God speak here when he says, now look at it. From the cloud, God said, this is my son, whom I love. Listen to him. Now, this declaration may remind some of you of the baptism of Jesus in Mark chapter 1. But unlike that event where God's declaration is given to Jesus, this declaration of God is directed to who? To the disciples. This is so good, especially in light of what we've heard Peter say leading up to this in chapter 8 and then just his last few statements. You see, it's almost as if God the Father breaks in and he says, yes, this is the Christ. This is the Messiah. This is the suffering Son of Man. This is the one who will pay the penal substitutionary penalty on your behalf. This is the one who will suffer many things. This is that one, but you need to also understand that this isn't just the Son of Man, this is the Son of God. Peter, shut up and listen to him. Listen to him. Some of you are going to go, you just said shut up. It's okay. It's okay. It's godly shut up, right? It's okay to say shut up in the church. No mention of Moses. No mention of Elijah. Not even a word about him. It's like, God, you want to build homes for these guys? You want to build homes for them? You want to build homes for Jesus? See those other two? Jesus made them. And you're going to build a home for them. Peter, what are you doing? This is my son, whom I love. And then God ends his declaration by saying, listen to him. I almost entitled my talk, listen to him. You see, Jesus isn't just some prophet. He is the fulfillment of all prophecies. Jesus doesn't come to teach the word. Jesus is the embodiment of the eternal word. A lot of people today want to make Jesus one of the prophets. We got whole religious movements based on that fact. There's some that want to come and say Jesus is just some great moralist, just a good teacher. God breaks in and says, what are you doing? This is my son, whom I love. And we see this passion in Jesus' own ministry. He says often, he says, those who have ears, let them hear. He says to the disciples, guys, why are you so dull? Do you have ears but don't hear? There's times where he rebukes them. We read in the aftermath of the feeding of the 5,000 that the disciples' hearts were hard. Jesus asked them many times, guys, can't you hear what I'm saying? As we saw last week, Jesus speaks plainly. And what does Peter do in the aftermath? Peter rebukes him. So Peter is talking about vacation property on the top of a mountain, basking in the glow of the glory of Jesus. And God just finally breaks in and says, listen to him. Jesus is the fulfillment of the old law, and he is the embodiment of the new. Listen to him. As Jesus says in John 10, my sheep listen to my voice. As Jesus gives in that great commission passage in the end of Matthew 28, he says, I command you to teach them everything, what? I have given you, that I have commanded you, teach them all of that, everything that I have said. It's that declaration. Does that mean that we don't teach the Old Testament? Does that mean that we don't teach the epistles or whatever? No, that means that we teach those things, but everything we teach in Scripture needs to be taught with the mindset of the revelation and the fulfillment of Jesus. Listen to him. You know, maybe I'm being simple here, but when God the Father says, listen to Jesus, you know what I think we should do? I think we should listen to Jesus. How about you? Listen to Jesus. I like what it says in verse 8. Look at verse 8, my favorite verse in the whole passage. It says, suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. I like that. See, I don't think that's just a point of fact. I think that's a call. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Let's finish it off. That's why we talk about Jesus here a lot. Because God says, listen to him. Let's pick it up, finish it off. Verse 9, and we'll read to the end. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had just seen until the Son of Man. That must have drove Peter nuts. He was like, oh, tick, man. Oh, okay. Until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing it. Yeah, that's where Peter got, you know, at least some sense of satisfaction. Discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, Why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? Jesus replied, to be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it was written about him. Again, and I think perhaps amazingly, at least for some of us, we are reminded in this last section that the disciples still don't fully understand the mission of Jesus. Do they? They don't. I mean, are they dull? Yeah, in a sense they are, but I think more specifically, I think they're blind, at least partially. I think they are somewhat blind still. And I think they need that veil to be removed, and I think that clarification, and we're going to see when that happens in just a moment. And I think their blindness is seen in their question of Jesus regarding Elijah in verse 11. Perhaps based on several texts, Malachi has several, Malachi 3 and Malachi 4, if you ever want to read that. And based on the teachers of the law who would have had, knowing the text, talking about the coming Elijah, there was this expectation that the prophet, the Old Testament prophet Elijah, would come back again. So there's this great expectation, and you can almost see their brains just working, their minds spinning, because they're coming down from the mountain, and they're getting this further revelation on who Jesus is. And so they ask, Jesus, if you are the Messiah, why does it say that Elijah must come first? Why is that? If you're the one you claim to be, are we missing something? Because there seems to be a lot of passages that talk about that, and our teachers of the law talk about it all the time. Jesus affirms their question, but he also smacks them right between the eyes. Because what Jesus says in response, he says basically this, you're right about Elijah. He does come first. You and your teachers of the law are correct in that. But then he asks the question, it's also written that the Son of Man must suffer much. How come? If you can get the teachings of Elijah, that you can't get the teachings and the prophecy about me. Who is the Elijah that Jesus says has come? Well, Matthew's account tells us, says this. You can read it again on the screen. Jesus replied, to be sure, Elijah comes and will restore all things. But I tell you, Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize them, but have done to him everything they wished. In the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist. I close by going back to verse 9. In verse 9, we see a command by Christ to keep silent. This is the last time that we will see this command in Mark's gospel. He gives this command 9 times. It's called the secrecy motif, the messianic secret, those types of theological terms attached to it. We see this over and over again, especially in the aftermath of great events, miracles, things like that. Don't tell anyone what you've seen. Don't tell anyone who I am. Those types of things. This is the last time that we see it in Mark's gospel. What stands out about it is that it's the only one given with a time limit attached. And what Jesus says to disciples, what you guys just saw on top of this mountain, don't tell anyone about it until I have risen from the dead. Now, this command reminds and reinforces something that we have seen throughout the gospel, which is this. The cross and the resurrection are the only vantage points from which to see Jesus' life and his ministry clearly. Until you see Jesus on the cross and resurrected thereafter, all knowledge of him is incomplete. And although this situation is wonderful, it's bewildering and wonderful, it's strangely beautiful, all of that, it's an event that gives us a taste, a foretaste, a prelude of that future glory, that resurrected glory. It's only a future and resurrected glory that is attainable through the death and resurrection of Jesus. So Jesus says, wait until I rise from the dead, then you'll understand this. And that's why the cross is the crux and center of our faith. It's not Pentecost. It's not the Sermon on the Mount. It's not living out James. All of those are vital. All of those important. All of those necessary. All of those needing to be part of our faith.
But it's the cross that's the center. Jesus says, wait until that, and then you'll understand this. So Jesus says, venture to the cross, and we do that weekly. We do that weekly through the symbol that's tied into the communion table. Because communion is a time of remembrance, it's a time of focus, where we come to the cross because it's at the cross where we see Jesus clearly. He calls us to the cross, but our hope is tied up in the cross. My desire today is that as you come and participate in communion, that you would only see Jesus. As we celebrate the suffering and now glorified Messiah. How we celebrate and remember communion. Again, if you're a guest with us, as you come forward, we'll have servers. Take the piece of bread that represents the body of Christ. Dip it into the wine or the juice, which represents the spilled blood of Jesus, and partake.